Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, in the essay Why We Write, journalist Robert Perry describes the need for an independent press to take on the mainstream media's penchant for promoting false narratives and marginalizing dissent. Bob Perry broke some of the most important stories in the last 30 years. He's the founder of the site ConsortiumNews.com. He'll join us to talk about why he writes. Also on the show, when corporate media talk about poor communities, their story is pretty simple. These neighborhoods are a problem, and gentrification is the solution. The story changes, though, if you actually value the opinions of those displaced. New research highlights these issues in Bay Area media. We'll talk to Carlo Schmieder from the Oakland-based Youth Media Council about their new report. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
We're used to seeing the media pushing candidates they deem unserious off the stage. The fact that such candidates often happen to be more progressive or critical of the status quo is probably not an accident, but it's strange to see that happen to one of the media's own designated frontrunners. With just a few weeks to go before the Iowa caucuses, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and John Edwards are more or less tied, but some in the media seem interested in making it a two-person race. The Washington Post's November 12th report on a major Iowa party event stressed the Clinton-Obama contest while noting that Edwards, quote, tried to elbow his way into the Clinton-Obama rivalry with a populist call for Democrats to stand up against corporate interests and cleanse Washington of the corrupting influence of money and power, close quote. Why would Edwards be considered a party crasher for speaking on issues that have been at the core of his campaign all along? Well, the same day, NBC Nightly News featured a look at candidates' spouses and had time for just two, Michelle Obama and Bill Clinton. Reporter Andrea Mitchell noted that Clinton and Obama were neck and neck in the latest polls from Iowa and closed by wondering if Obama could post a strong showing in the state's caucuses. This despite the fact that Edwards has, by most accounts, campaigned more in Iowa and his wife Elizabeth has been a much more active part of his campaign. Does the press corps really think the public has such a short memory, or is it just them?
A Wall Street Journal article on November 13th had a familiar refrain: the Democrats are in trouble because Congress is unpopular, and the solution is to be nicer to the Republicans. After quoting Representative Barney Frank saying, if you try to be too political, there's a backlash, reporter David Rogers says, quote, that backlash is evident. Congress's approval rating has fallen from 31% in March to 19% this month in the latest Wall Street Journal NBC News poll, close quote. He goes on to offer advice on how the Democrats can soften the tone and overcome the often crippling partisan bitterness. It's true that Congress is quite unpopular, but before House Speaker Nancy Pelosi accepts the Wall Street Journal's advice, she might want to take a look at why that's so. Consider the Iraq War, identified by the Journal as a key issue that makes cooperation harder. According to a September ABC Washington Post poll, 35% of the public feels that Congress has gone too far in opposing the war in Iraq, while 55% thinks it hasn't gone far enough. Only 5% say it's been just right, which starts to explain why Congress's approval ratings are so low. By following the Journal's conciliatory strategy, the Democrats would be trying to appeal to the 35%, who are no doubt mostly Republicans. Taking a harder line on the war, on the other hand, would be more likely to win over the 55%, who are overwhelmingly Democrats and independents. Funny how corporate media's advice givers never suggest that Democrats give that a try.
For many, Don Imus, with his history of bigotry, got what he deserved when he was fired by CBS and MSNBC for calling the Rutgers women's basketball team some nappy-headed hoes last April. But that's not the way many high-profile news figures see it. According to the New York Observer, political and media people who say they will return to appear on Imus's new show include pundit James Carville, NBC's Tim Russert, and New Yorker media reporter Ken Auletta. Some defend Imus as a casualty of political correctness who paid too high a price for a rare lapse in judgment. New York Times Book Review editor Sam Tannenhaus told The Observer Imus had been treated too harshly and deserved another chance. The New Yorker's Auletta told The Observer he would return to the show, quote, because I think people deserve second chances. If you believe in rehabilitation, if you don't believe in the death penalty, you believe that some people can be reformed and changed, close quote. But Imus's record of racism, sexism, and other bigotry goes back years, and he wasn't actually threatened with death, but simply with the loss of a megaphone for his hatred. From 1998, when Imus admitted to 60 Minutes, he'd hired an on-air sidekick to do nigger jokes to his firing last year for the Rutgers slur, with many bigoted rants in between. Imus has proven himself a racist recidivist. So the issue is not about second chances, but about whether American media culture and the white men who dominate it choose to challenge or to promote racists. As African-American columnist Richard Prince told The Observer, quote, "I think it would be interesting if you were to find black women, white women, men of color who are saying, oh, there's nothing wrong with this, so give the guy a break. He just made a mistake. I don't know how many of those you'd find," close quote.
The right-wing website Drudge Report recently catapulted the question of whether Hillary Clinton tipped a waitress into national newspaper headlines. On November 8th, Drudge seized upon a minor point in an NPR interview broadcast the same day with Anita Esterday, a waitress who had served Democratic presidential hopeful Hillary Clinton a sandwich. NPR's original segment had interviewed Esterday about her response to the way the brief encounter with Clinton was used by the senator as a talking point in her Iowa campaign tour. In the interview, the waitress mentioned that she and her colleagues had not received a tip. In the segment, it was a very minor point, but not for Drudge, whose headline proclaimed, "Hillary restaurant stop in Iowa. Nobody got left a tip." The Clinton campaign issued a statement denying it. They said staffers left money with someone else in the restaurant. That was picked up by AP, and over subsequent days, the allegations and counter-allegations were covered by the New York Times, the Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, and other dailies, Fox News, ABC News, even the Australian Broadcasting Association picked up on it. All of which prompted the waitress in question to offer the media a tip. Quote, "There's kids dying in the war, the price of oil right now. There's better things in this world to be thinking about than who served Hillary Clinton at Maid Rite and who got a tip and who didn't get a tip." Close quote. If media want to demonstrate that they care about such real people as more than props, they might take her advice.
And finally, media justice advocates generally make the case that corporate media don't show a fundamental interest in serving the community, and that their promises that they will do that better if they are allowed to get bigger are baseless. Sometimes, though, corporate media make the case themselves. What else is there to say about the new ad campaign from the CW network, recently created from the merging of the UPN and WB television channels, promoting the fact that the network now has no news in certain markets? In one ad, according to Timothy Carr of the group Free Press, a professor declares that the good news about a CW station is no news. In another, a rapper declares, "No news, ain't that a blast?" Evidently, CW's corporate owners at CBS and Time Warner have forgotten the part in the license agreement where it says they have access to public airwaves in exchange for broadcasting that serves the public interest, convenience, and necessity. Now let's see if the FCC remembers. For extra irony, the CW's new ads ran at the same time as the FCC held a hearing in Seattle where advocates sent the message that democracy can't survive on junk media.
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the media watch group FAIR. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the program.
How bad journalism harms and how good journalism can make things better, and what role media have played in bringing the United States to its current state of affairs are basic questions addressed in Why We Write, an essay published by ConsortiumNews.com on November 13th and written by the site's founder, Robert Perry. Before founding Consortium News, Perry broke some of the most important stories of the past 30 years, including several scoops on the Iran-Contra scandal for the Associated Press and Newsweek. His latest book, co-written with his sons Sam and Nat, is Neck Deep: The Disastrous Presidency of George W. Bush. Robert Perry joins us now by telephone from Virginia. Robert Perry, welcome back to Counterspin.
Well, thanks for having me.
Robert, near the beginning of your piece, you say that in trying to understand what's gone wrong with the U.S. political system in the last three decades, quote, I have come to view the core problem as the use of mass media to inject Americans with a synthetic reality that misrepresents recent history, exaggerates external dangers, and ridicules the few citizens who object, close quote. That's a lot of responsibility for the press. What do you mean by synthetic realities or, as you refer to them elsewhere, false narratives?
Well, the idea of false narrative would be to try to explain to the American people how things are happening or why things are happening based on historical facts that aren't really facts, or put differently, perhaps cherry-picked facts. And we've seen this evolve over the last 30 years in particular, especially after the era of the Watergate period and the Vietnam War protests, which were followed by the American news media becoming more aggressive, doing stories like the Pentagon Papers, which actually revealed real narrative. So at that point, in around the mid-70s, we saw this effort, a very concerted effort by folks, particularly on the right, who felt harmed by the Watergate scandal and by these other events in journalism, to essentially rewrite history and to establish a narrative that would serve their ends. And in many cases, this relied on misinterpreting facts, selecting pieces of information that tended to support the narrative, but were not really accurate or truthful. So what we had as America move forward was increasingly sets of false narratives. Sometimes they could relate to larger issues like who won the Cold War or how it was won, or sometimes it could relate to individuals as to whether or not they're liars or whether they are good public servants. So you had this combination, this ability to present American people with accounts that weren't real. And I think as this period evolved and we saw groups like the neoconservatives step forward, they were particularly adept at setting up these false narratives and pushing them.
Well, give us a concrete example or two of how some of these false narratives arose and how some of them still infuse our public discussion today.
Well, one of the early ones, I would guess, would be when you get to the mid-1970s. At that point, the Central Intelligence Agency was beginning to detect signs of a Soviet decline. One of my intelligence sources told me over lunch once that at that point, the best sources the CIA had in Moscow were recounting the technological failures and other stumblings of the Soviet system. It was becoming essentially dysfunctional by that period of the early to mid-70s. This information helped shape what Secretary of State Kissinger and then President Nixon and President Ford called their strategies of détente, that was to negotiate some of the more dangerous elements of the Cold War so that the world would be a lot safer place, to essentially bring the Cold War to a conclusion at that phase. This was seen as a threat to some of the old Cold Warriors, some of their military-industrial backers, and to a group that was beginning to emerge then, the group we now call the neoconservatives. They first sort of arose in a very interesting event, which occurred in 1976, when then CIA Director George H.W. Bush, under pressure from the right, allowed in this team of right-wing ideologues to examine the CIA's intelligence on the Soviet Union. This became known as the Team B experiment. And despite the evidence that the CIA was assembling of a declining Soviet Union, the neocons, this group was essentially headed by a young arms control expert named Paul Wolfowitz. This group essentially cherry-picked the evidence and still concluded what they wanted to conclude, that the Soviet Union was this Leviathan that was surrounding and threatening the United States. And that idea sort of picked up pace in the late 70s as the right wing built their own news media, began to push these ideas. There was a group called the Committee on the Present Danger that was very influential. They talked about the window of vulnerability in which the Soviet Union was going to be able to have a first strike against the United States and possibly force the U.S. to surrender. It was all rather alarmist, and as we look back at it, kind of crazy. This was the shape of the false narrative that really took hold of the United States in the 1980s with Ronald Reagan's major military buildup, the support of dirty wars in Central America and insurgencies like that fought in Nicaragua against the Sandinista government or in Angola against that government. So there was this tremendous push to conduct these kinds of operations with the sense that there was a great, great danger that was getting worse for the United States, when the reality was the Soviet Union was stumbling toward its end. And ironically, when you get to the latter part of the 1980s and the Soviet Union actually collapses, the CIA, which has been under enormous pressure not to see these signs of decay, was accused of missing the collapse of the Soviet Union. But it really wasn't true. They'd been sort of blinded, so they couldn't see the collapse of the Soviet Union. And then when you get to that period, instead of accepting that maybe the CIA was right back in the 1970s, that the Soviet Union was heading toward a demise, the new false narrative the neocons put together was that Ronald Reagan had won the Cold War by being tough, by having the military buildup, by supporting these wars around the world. And that essentially has continued to color how Americans see the world and who's allowed to shape that vision up to the present. The neocons came back in force with George W. Bush's presidency, and they continued their old tricks. They exaggerated dangers, they cherry-picked the evidence, and that set the stage for the United States going into Iraq. So we still have the same ideas, the idea of creating these notions of larger dangers than really exist, and that then driving U.S. foreign policy.
Well, it seemed that the false narratives also inform the debate around a possible Iranian incursion. Bob Perry, why do you think the press is the core problem? Couldn't it just be that they're following official agendas, taking their lead, say, from the White House?
Well, to some degree, that's certainly true. But what happened when you go back to that again, to that very important period of the mid to late 70s, what the right did was it organized itself, got together its foundations, began to invest heavily in building a media infrastructure. And that included their own magazines, ultimately their own newspapers, radio stations, television networks. They also built organizations to go after individual reporters, groups like Accuracy in Media and some of the media research groups that the right has. So they put a lot of pressure on the mainstream journalists to toe the line. And those of us who were in the mainstream press in that time felt this pressure enormously. They would try to lobby our editors to fire us or to demote us. So over a period of time, it became clear to most working journalists, especially in Washington, that their careers were not well served by trying to maintain the high standards of journalism, that is, really seeking the truth, questioning those in power and those trying to sell them these lines. It became easier to go along with it. And so I think it was a combination. There was certainly the pressure from people in government, and especially the neocons, but it was also true that the American press corps had very little incentive to continue to fight for the truth. And in fact, the incentive went the other way, to go along. So this combination of factors has led the country to the mess it's in right now.
While many journalists have helped to promote false narratives, certainly this show has spent a lot of time spotlighting them over the years, it's also true that good journalism must be the antidote. Isn't this the key to your headline, Why We Write?
Sure. The whole point of what we tried to do at ConsortiumNews.com when I founded it back in 1995 was to sort of maintain those old journalistic standards and just put them into a new medium, the Internet. The idea was that this would be a way to sort of circumvent some of the obstructions and pressures that I was encountering, but many other journalists also were encountering. So that was the point. And if there is going to be a hope to reestablish a kind of honest narrative for the country, which is vital in a democracy, I think you do have to have journalists who are truly committed to getting at the truth, not simply playing along. So I think in that case, there really has to be a significant investment of time, effort, resources into getting that kind of an operation up and going.
We've been speaking with Robert Perry, founder of ConsortiumNews.com and co-author most recently of Neck Deep, The Disastrous Presidency of George W. Bush. Bob Perry, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
There's an unstated assumption in most corporate news media that poor neighborhoods, particularly those where people of color live, are problems. And so if the story is housing and development, things are quite clear. Wealthier people and interests should be credited for developing such places, and residents should be happy to escape them. Such assumptions help fuel cycles of community transformation that are dramatically changing cities across the country. But of course, corporate media's storyline is not common sense, but just one particular worldview, one that privileges profit-making over people. There are few issues of more concern right now than housing, so expanding the media discussion about problems and responses is critical. And a new report is aimed at doing just that. It comes from the Youth Media Council, the Oakland-based Media Strategy and Action Center, and it's called Displacing the Dream. Joining us now from the Bay Area to talk about it is Carlo Schmieder, a strategist with the Youth Media Council. Welcome to Counterspin, Carlo Schmieder.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm excited about it.
Well, Displacing the Dream is interesting both for its product, the research, and its process. But let's start with what you all looked at. The phenomena are certainly not just national, but global. But you focused on the Bay Area in particular, and you looked at the San Francisco Chronicle, the Oakland Tribune, and the San Jose Mercury News.
Yeah, we did about 3 months of coverage. We figured that was enough time to get the real normal ebbs and flows of the news cycle and see exactly how they were talking about this issue.
Well, so what would you say were the major findings?
Well, we found some great gems and some great stories that actually talked about real conditions that people were living with on the ground. Overall, we found that there were two major failures in the coverage, and one was to tell this, deeper story that you mentioned early in your intro about really what's happening overall. And also it failed to really tell the very real human impacts of development on communities.
Well, when you talk about kind of missing the basic story, you're talking about the fact that, and looking at the research here, you look at 334 stories, and it seems like although they're talking about housing and they're talking about gentrification, really, what they didn't talk about was displacement, was the people who get moved out.
Exactly. When we look at how stories are created and put out there by media, they usually go in a pretty simple format. They talk about a problem, a solution, and what people can do to be a part of the solution and help with the problem. And what we found was that displacement just wasn't a problem in the sample that we pulled. Even though, just from living in the Bay Area and living here, we understand that that's the main discussion that's happening at kitchen tables across the Bay Area is what is affordable housing. And, how can we get enough affordable housing for working-class families and working-class communities to be able to stay in the city?
And the context, of course, is that just in terms of African-Americans, the Bay Area has lost something like 20 to 25% over just the last 5 years. Isn't that right?
Yeah, the census numbers show an alarming trend of African-American families being forced out of the city. We think it's a little bit different than the normal cycles that happen, with people moving in and moving out of places. And it's really being driven by the way the economies are working in cities. Mm-hmm. And as a result, development, not only in press, but just in the politics of the city, developers really, by where they're situated in the whole thing, really control the debate, not only in the newspapers, but, as I said, throughout the political and democratic processes.
And, of course, that dovetails with corporate news media's tendency to sort of favor the private over the public in general. Well, you talked about how the problem is defined, what's not a problem. What about solutions? I mean, what is talked about as the solution to what problems do arise in these transformations?
The solutions that the study brought up were very heavily corporate solutions. And really, just corporate development is the solution mm-hmm. over and over again. And not necessarily community solutions that are driven by folks that really have a stake in the community and want the community to be a real livable place for working class communities.
Well, that sort of leads us directly to who is getting to talk in these stories. Who did you find was getting to speak? Who was given voice in the coverage on these issues?
Government officials really dominated the debate. Mm-hmm. Which is interesting if the solutions are really about corporate development. Residents, people who are affected by the issue, organizations who are directly working on the issue, we found just scant instances where they were speaking in the issues.
And residents are more kind of people on the street, more sort of color, to use the term, than actual sources of information.
Yeah, and not folks affected, right? It was that people on the street journalistic kind of tactic that goes over pretty easy in journalism, but doesn't necessarily always tell us the deeper story of, who's organized in the community? What are folks doing? What are their solutions? What are the community solutions being put forward? And how can we all work together to make those solutions really viable?
Well, we remember a story about foreclosures in Time magazine in which the angle was, how can you basically grab a home out from under someone who's having trouble making payments without feeling bad about yourself, you know? So in news media, perspective, of course, is determined not just by who gets to speak, but also what are the assumptions the outlet seems to have about who their reader is, you know, who's reading it. I want to talk finally about the way you did this, because you're really interested in opening up a dialogue, not just with the results of the report, but also with the process. What was different about the way that you did this, and why did you do it that way?
Well, we're calling it Content Analysis 2.0. We think that, you know, often research, even media research, is done in a way that, you know, as academics, they pull the stories and then they talk about it and they put out a report on what they found. We thought it would be more interesting in the line of the way, similarly to the way that we're seeing news change the way it's happening, right? We want it to be much more of a dialogue and not a lecture. Mm-hmm. So we brought people who were directly affected in the issue into the process to create not only the research questions, but do the coding and help us with analysis so that the folks that we thought were really affected by this issue had a chance to tell their story.
All right, then. Folks who want to find out more about that story can find it on your website. We've been speaking with Carlo Schmieder of the Youth Media Council in Oakland. You can find information on Displacing the Dream and on their other projects on their website, youthmediacouncil.org. Thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. That number again, 1-800-847-3993. Be sure and tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's www.fair.org. The website's also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.